and welcome to this week's VFX show. I'm Mike Seymour. For the dark side of the VFX show, I'm joined by Mark Christensen. How are you, sir?
Whoa, I'm good. Thanks, Mike.
And Matt Walden, how are you, sir?
I am excellent, thank you.
Now, to get around the other side of the moon for Transformers 3, we've actually positioned our hosts around the globe for full maximum impact. So we actually have, I think we're speaking from three continents. So, Matt, starting with you, you're in the most unusual place, perhaps. Where are you?
I am in Iceland, and I've been here for a couple of weeks, and I'll be here for about 2 weeks more, and working on a couple of things that I can't really talk about right now, but I will. You'll probably know more about them in about around June next year.
Excellent. And Mark, you're on the other side of the planet, but still in the Northern Hemisphere.
Yes, closer, sort of splitting the distance between you two, I guess, in San Francisco.
And, of course, I'm coming to you from Sydney, whereas you guys are probably enjoying a northern summer. I'm enjoying a hellish winter. It's completely... Yeah. It's basically torrential rain down here. Now, I've just been in Europe, so I'm used to, like, sunny side of the world. So I've got to say, I think you guys have the advantage. But that's given me nothing to do but ponder this film. So let's get into it. And let's start with you, Mark. Did you like this third installment of robots that would be cars?
I was pleasantly surprised by this movie. My jaw was on the floor at certain parts of it. If I'm Michael Bay, and I think, you know, we should all get the chance to be Michael Bay for at least a day, I would have maybe cut a bit out of some of it. It felt a bit long. And but, you know, it was an over-the-top part three of a trilogy. Who knows if it ends there? But as such, I think it was really grand. I was really struck by the fact I looked this movie up on Flixster, which is an iPhone app I use to get movies, and they put the Rotten Tomato ratings on there, and the critics gave this thing sort of like a 36%, and the fans gave it 90. I've never seen a split like that. So I think it was a fan-pleasing, really fun, and pretty awesome experience.
And so, Matt, are you joining the Cybertronic spacecraft to the sort of dark side or not?
Yeah, you know, I'm a man of two minds when it comes to this film. I think this is the VFX show, and from a VFX point of view, I am convinced, although I have not seen the new Harry Potter film yet, but I'm convinced this is the film to beat come Academy Awards time for visual effects. I was... With the exception of one or two shots that are very minor, and we can talk about those later, this film, from an effects point of view, blew my mind. My 7-year-old son and his best buddy, another 7-year-old, who I went to see this movie with, literally were sitting on the edge of their seats in the last third of the film, as was I. And my son turned to his friend at one point and said, "This is the most awesome battle scene ever." He screamed to his friend, and they were both like giddy. And I just thought, you know, this is what these kind of movies are about. This is what these movies are for. This is the key audience for these films. You know, if I were to really, you know, put on my cinephile hat and look at this and say, like, you know, is this a great movie? You know, I certainly could have my qualms with the story. I mean, we could go on for hours about the whole Transformers franchise. But that's not really the point of this kind of film, I think. And for what it was after and the market that it was targeted towards, I mean, I walked out of the theater. I felt like I got my money's worth. For sure.
So I mentioned earlier I was in Europe, and I actually saw this in Europe. I saw it in Copenhagen, in actually a really good cinema in Copenhagen. We were there. It happened to be that we'd been traveling for a while with my family, and my daughters had been really well-behaved and doing all the sort of things that they should do. We had a rainy day. We went, let's go and see the new Transformers, which had just opened. And we saw it. They're huge Transformers fans. And I should also point out, you know, they are quite well educated in the art, I guess, but they loved it to death. Now, they are diehard Transformer fans. They really, I mean, my daughter has a prized ILM crew T-shirt from T2, so the Transformers 2 thing, so really loved it to death. That being said, I totally agree with you. There is two ways to cut this film. I'm going to do the first cut now, and then we'll move on to the VFX. The first cut is just as a film and as a plot, and then the second is as effects. And I have seen Harry Potter 7 Part 2, and I'll discuss that when we get to the VFX section, because I think that is the film that's going to give this one a run for its money at the Oscars. But
interesting.
Let's just discuss it for the film first. And for the film first, there was, I guess my problem is that Bay himself came out and said that in the second movie they kind of got burnt because the writer's strike, and that they didn't do it. He actually said, and I'm quoting now, it was a fuck scenario all the way around. It wasn't fair to the writer, it wasn't fair to me, it wasn't fair to anyone. I still think it was an entertaining movie, but we failed in certain aspects. But with this movie, referring now to the third one, I think we have a much better script and got back to basics. Now, my problem is that if this is the better script version, then I don't think that we've really solved the problem. I think that inherently this film is a VFX film, that you're going to see basically robot disaster porn, much sure. in the same way of 2012, with only a slightly better story. And I'll tell you why I think it's so appallingly bad. It's as if he's just got so good at action sequences that he just needs to string them together, and that everybody says, you know what, it's a Michael Bay film, I'll just cut him some slack on that and give him a pass. And
that's pretty much what I did.
And to see whether I was just getting old, I went back and watched Bad Boys 2. Mm-hmm. And you know what? It was exactly the same. It's like the slimmest kind of drug premise, but it was just huge action chase sequence followed by huge other comedy piece by huge other action sequence. So this is, I guess my only defense is that if you go to see a Michael Bay film and expect something else, there's right. no precedence for that. So you'd just be naive. So I think you can be too much on your high horse and say,
sure.
There was no script and blah, blah, blah. And honestly, it's a bit like saying, you know, I went and saw Justin Bieber. I don't think that the orchestral arrangements were quite as delicate as I'd anticipated. And it's like, yeah. dude, get a life. What did you expect?
Yeah, exactly. And said, I think that's a really important point, though, because I do think that, like, you know, movies are an art form, movies are a business, and movies are a form of entertainment. And given that, like, there are certain kinds of movies for whom, you know, the script, the action, the effects and what have you, they're targeted towards a given audience. And I think, you know, for people like us, maybe who, and maybe a lot of the people listening to the show, people who are really, you know, serious fans of film and of filmmaking and really regard it as a high art form, you know, when we go to look at a film like this, you know, we might all, you know, kind of scoff at some of the things that Michael Bay does and whatnot. And we remember, you know, films that we grew up with, like, you know, Star Wars or the first Star Wars trilogy or Alien or whatever, and films that really resonate on an effects level and on a story level. And we might scoff at some of the things that are in this, but, you know, for kids growing up today, you know, this is just as arresting and as effective as those movies were for us. But we're older now, you know, we're looking at it with, like, the eye of a of, you know, seasoned professionals and whatnot. I think we have to make excuses on some level. I actually think
this is, you know what, really, I think it's more than that. I think this is of a video game culture, where in a video game you need to get from A to B, and the plot isn't central to the fun, but it doesn't need to be, because the fun is so much fun that you don't need the plot to be the driving reason for playing the game. Mm-hmm. And I just think that's the same with this. You don't go to these films for the plot, you go for the action sequences, and they're so good, the action sequences, that you cut it some slack. But can I just parody it slightly for a second before we get to the VFX? Because there are just a couple of pieces that even I choked on. My main one, and I don't know if you've got any better ones than this, of just downright, there's actually two that I just thought were just downright, I just couldn't believe it got through editorial. The first was that, okay, I've got three, maybe five. Anyway, the first one is Optimus Prime gets tangled in some cables, and this takes him out of the action for about 20 minutes. And I'm sorry, but if you can take on three or four killer robots and it's just some cables that are going to stop you, well, why didn't you mention that earlier? We could have just thrown some cables over any of them and, like, you know, saved ourselves a lot of insurance underwriting damage, because it seemed absurd to me that you could just get him tangled, and then that would be the only way they could think of as a plot device to keep him out of the action to bring him in later. The second huge plot thing that I just couldn't get, but it's sort of related to VFX, I guess, is that this awesome skydiving jump sequences into Chicago. And as soon as they were over, I was like, man, that was just some really kick-ass stuff. And I will discuss it from a VFX point of view later. And then they seemed to climb up a building and do it again. And the only reason I could think of is that everyone agreed that the first one was so cool, they should just have some more of it. And for no apparent reason could I understand why they did that. And then finally, from an editorial point of view, there seemed to be some huge sections of the film just cut out. Like, I really do think that somebody edited this. You said Michael Bay should have cut out more. But an example I'll give you is there seemed to be quite a big thing about Optimus having his trailer, you know, his, like, container load of tools and stuff that he needed.
Oh, yeah.
And it goes in at one point and it gets knocked off him. And he goes, oh, no, God, I've got to get my trailer back because I'll need that to fight. So that, you know, that was an actual piece of dialogue. It wasn't just sort of me noticing that he had it. And it was very deliberately knocked off him. It was also shown very clearly in earlier sequences and tied in, as my daughter's pointed out, to earlier films. And yet it never reappeared and he never seemed to find it again. And I just assumed that that was a whole subplot they sort of cut out. And so the thing for me is that I find it hard to watch the film and not get taken out of the film when we have just seemingly incongruous things happening. So I, at that level, at that filmmaking level, as we want nothing to take us out of the film because we want to be as immersive as possible in the narrative story, I do find it annoying. But I don't know, is there anything in the film, just before we get to the VFX, that was like that for you, that you just found yourself being pulled out of the film because it just made no sense?
I think I heard the ultimate Michael Bay line in this film, shorten the kill chain. I think that's just so awesome. The guys in the squirrel suits, now I'm no expert, but if you start those dives at the top of the Sears Tower, which is a little over 1,000 feet high, they're not going to go on for 10 minutes. But also, I don't think you could land that. I mean, I think you got to be in, you're well past parachute land, to be honest, at that point. But I like I said, I'm no expert. The more to the point, when that came up, I was just like, oh my God, somebody thought they really wanted to get the guys in the squirrel suits. And it was like, all right, here we go.
But the first one out of the plane was valid.
They were fun. They were fun. But pointless. Now, I'll throw a little credit back, and the thing about the writing on this film, they did at least find a way to get some characterizations into these robots. I'm not saying I laughed, I cried, it changed my life. I mean, I might have laughed a little bit. But, I mean, you know, they gave the animators really a lot to do on this film that before I think they did a lot of action, but I think they got to do a lot of other stuff, some of the smaller characters on this, and we'll get to that, I'm sure.
I would say, too, from a script point of view and from an execution point of view, there were two things that really stuck out to me, aside from the things maybe both of you guys mentioned, which would be, I found the introductory shot of the new suction cup-lipped sort of Megan Fox replacement actress to be one that was so gratuitous. Like, I mean, it felt like something out of like a Rip Curl Surf Girls commercial video thing.
Was that the bus shot?
Yeah, where it was
remember in the second one, she was airbrushing a motorcycle while wearing virtually no clothes in the most gratuitous soft porn sequence we've seen.
I totally concur with you on that, Mike, but at the same time, I think this one was bigger. This one was more over the top. And then the other thing was...
It is hard, yeah.
I did feel like the first...
That's a hard sort of thing to top, isn't it, really?
You're not going to have a Michael Bay movie without the pouting girl with shit exploding behind her.
Oh, in slow-mo. Yeah, no, it's fine. But and the
Mike
awesome
already
ability
dropped
to remain
an F-bomb.
In good makeup. In good makeup.
The other thing I thought was just from an overall pacing and script point of view, I thought that there was something about the first, third of the movie, to me, editorially and script-wise, that felt really... I don't know if you guys would agree with this. It felt clumsy, and I was kind of like, oh my God, this is like a train wreck. Like, for the first third of the movie, I wasn't really sure where we were going. I wasn't sure what was going to happen. I knew, you know, just from the, you know, sort of the onslaught of ads that I'd seen on television that we were going to go somewhere that was pretty exciting, but at the same time, that first third of the movie felt really clumsy and awkward in a way that, I mean, I come to this from, you know, having basically been, you know, forced to watch Transformers 1 and 2 because my son My son is super into those movies. He has watched them probably a dozen times at least each, and can recite lines from them. He's totally obsessed with them. So I've seen them many times, and I know their successes and their flaws quite well because of it. And so watching this, I was probably as excited as my son, maybe close to as excited as him, to go see this movie. And that first third of the movie to me felt really awkward, really clumsy, and I wasn't sure where we were headed. And it seemed like
I totally agree. I think there was really bad editing.
The pacing, yeah, it was really off.
Yeah. I'll give you an example of really poor editing. There's a sequence where he discovers, or he believes, that he understands that Leonard Nimoy's bot is a bad guy. And it's like, we got to go get him. And the next thing you see, they've kind of found him. We don't know how. We don't know where. And they're suddenly driving along a road, and there's some guys chasing them kind of thing. And it's just really confusing editing as to what just happened. And we just felt like I skipped a reel in the film.
Yeah.
And it was fine when you had the individual sequences, like when those characters then stopped and fought each other and beat each other up. And that was fine. And the sequences in Chicago were fine, but it was as if somebody had set pieces, edited together as set pieces, but the general editing, like away from the visual effects editing, I thought was some of the worst editing I've seen in years.
Yeah, I agree.
Okay, that being said, let's stop all that now, switch to the VFX, and I have to say, and I want to say it right after that, if that was the worst editing I've seen in years, this is some of the best visual effects work I've seen in years. This is without a doubt just monumentally good visual effects work.
Here, here.
I mean, it's staggering.
Mm-hmm.
Let's discuss a few of the sequences and a few of the approaches. I'm going to start with actually the stuff that was, I think, in the trailer, but it certainly was in the beginning of the film. They go to the Apollo moon stuff, and there are two things there I think worth discussing. Firstly, there's the Forrest Gump-esque way they handled some of that stuff.
Mm-hmm.
There were sort of lots of historical tricks, and then also there was just the incredibly cool and very well executed moon on the moon stuff, which was obviously not so much using old footage. And Mark, what did you think of the let's start with the Forrest Gumpy kind of stuff, because there was Nixon, there was Obama, there was, I think, Kennedy. Yeah, there was Kennedy.
Yeah,
how'd you find that?
Yeah. Believe it or not, that was one of my jaw on the floor sequences. I was really blown away by that set of montages, and I really actually wanted to switch off my critical mind after a while and just enjoy the whole texture and flavor of how they did that. And, you know, it's always tough. I mean, they did a few different approaches to Kennedy, and the actual actor they got in there wasn't, you know, he wasn't a perfect fit. Nobody ever is, but it didn't really matter. I mean, the feel of it and the visual language they used to conjure it, it didn't feel like tricks. It felt like, oh my God, was there this good cinematography of that era? I've just never seen it. Because seeing some of those shots, and it almost made me wish that people had been that creative about how to cover Apollo 11, etc.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
I thought the historical montage was really good. Like, if I was criticized, as I say, the editing, it wasn't inside a sequence like that, because that sequence was tight, was well put together, and it was very subtle. Obviously, like the Obama sequence, I thought, worked particularly well in intercutting live action with a stand-in actor, and then sometimes you'd have people out of focus, and you'd have, you know, footage on monitors that were footage that we knew and for the real people. So I thought, what did you think, Matt? I thought that was, like, really well handled, given that it's always going to be hard to pull off.
I felt like the Nixon and the Obama stuff worked really great. I liked that they threw Nixon out of focus. I thought that really helped make that function well. But I have to take issue with the Kennedy stuff, in that there was one shot that was a little long in the Kennedy sequence. And somebody said, I tweeted something about this after I saw it, because I thought the effects were stellar, save for the one shot of what looked to me like a video game resolution character execution of JFK. And it was so, like, I just thought it was really just so blatantly, it looked like a, you know, like a temp. It didn't even look like anything that was close to a final. It looked really I mean, I thought it was so, the animation was wooden, the textures, the lighting on the character was really bad, and I just thought it looked like some, I was like, wait, whoa, huh? What? Like, where are we going here? Like, it took me totally out of the film. It looked really implausible. And somebody later said they thought that was an actor that was cast to play Kennedy, and I can't believe that that's true. If it was an actor, it was like an actor out of like Madame Tussauds' wax museum. I mean, it wasn't a person. Like, it was a video game, like really low res, bad texture, badly lit character. It was poor. There was one shot of Kennedy that was really bad.
I do, and it was a kind of a long shot, and it did look like a digital double. And there was one other one, but later, but it was where you'd expect to see a digital double that I noticed.
I must have been eating popcorn at this point, because I don't recall this shot, but I don't recall.
I remember there being three Kennedy shots, and one was good, right, because it was mostly about the hair.
Yep.
And I think it was even from behind,
right,
so that was fine.
Yeah, that
and then there was that long one that you're talking about. And they did have, they were moving the camera around a lot.
But do you, somebody told me they thought that was an actor. And I think if that was an actor, it was like,
yeah,
you know, they deserve a Razzie. Like, it was the most wooden actor I've ever seen. Like, and I'm not one to be.
No, to me, they slipped a digital double in there.
Sorry, I just think it was a digital double. And it was a digital double that was like,
yeah,
it was really poor. I think they could, I think it would have been better. I just saw like a clip of, I didn't watch the thing, but I saw a clip of that thing that in the U.S. anyway got banned because the Kennedys protested it. But that Kennedy miniseries,
yep, I saw
or whatever,
that series.
And
yep,
it had Greg Kinnear as Kennedy. And I got to say, in a couple of the shots that I saw, just sort of glancing at this thing on TV, Greg Kinnear did a great job. He had the hair, he had the look, he had the wince, yep, and there were a couple moments where I was like, man, he looks like Kennedy right there, right? From all the newsreel footage
that
we know.
In that TV series? Yeah, the only criticism of that TV series, I think, was Jackie O. I think most people thought his Kennedy performance was really good, but her Jackie O was less than stellar.
Well, yeah, she wasn't a side talker, right? She didn't talk out of the side of her mouth like Katie Holmes. But I just thought, you know, if they wanted to do that Kennedy sequence like that, and they couldn't get a digital double to work that well, just get an actor. Get an actor to sit in there. And that was not an actor in that one shot in particular. And it really stuck out. And probably most people wouldn't have noticed it. But, I mean, for an effects film, an effects-heavy film, and, you know, to do a kind of Forrest Gump-esque sequence like that, you know, you got to know that anybody and everybody in the effects world is going to be looking at that. And it was a tough one. It didn't work.
I will say, I don't think it was as good as Forrest Gump. Like, I think it was more obvious that they were doing tricks to work their way around between body doubles and so.
Yeah.
But it was a smaller sequence as well. It wasn't as
right,
pivotal to the story as Forrest Gump. But as a sequence, as a montage, but I must have missed this shot that you're referring to because I clearly was trying to sort out kids' ice creams.
I would say, though, that being said, though, the Apollo stuff, like being on the moon, there was one great shot that was in the trailer of the Apollo capsule. And it looked like something like a 2011 version of something from Apollo 13. You know, it had that great, like, really hard light, hard shadow, sort of no atmospheric diffusion and stuff. And that shot was just super dead on. It was tight, totally photoreal, looked great. And all the stuff of them walking on the surface of the moon, going towards the ship and stuff, I mean, it had the right kind of dynamics. And it was fun. It was neat. It made me think, like, God, how cool would it be to see, you know, a really brand new filmic version of, you know, of the Apollo 11, you know, the mission, like a Hollywood telling of that story? That would be great. I'd love to see something like that.
I kind of wonder if that was John Knowles' model, because he was showing off a side project about a decade ago.
Yeah.
I don't know if you ever saw
that.
That's really good.
Yeah.
Where he built
So they obviously, that sequence notwithstanding, we've got the actual characters. Let's discuss the actual Transformers themselves. And I'm not talking about chronologically in the film now. I just mean sort of generally speaking. There was a reboot, or not a reboot, there was a revision, I guess, to most of the main characters. Certainly the cars they were driving were presumably product placement updates. But just in terms of the animation, they looked similar to what they were, but had been given a bit of an update. The villains, however, obviously were massively different. So what do we actually think of the robots? Because from the first Transformers on, one of the most impressive things, I think, from a visual effects point of view, is just the articulated nature of the robots, the number of parts in them, just the sheer complexity of them. And just for those of you that don't know, let me just give you a couple of quick stats as we head into this discussion. So I believe that Colossus had around 10,000 parts. Actually, no, I think Optimus Prime had about 10,000. Yeah.
70,000.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Colossus had about seven times that. So that's a pretty astonishing amount of stuff. And from a computational point of view, that meant it was phenomenally hard to render and do stuff. In fact, I think Colossus, which we'll discuss in the Chicago stuff, was up at 290 hours a frame, and the render farm at ILM, which is a smoking render farm to start with, apparently was just thumping and I mean, really pushing to get all this stuff done. We're also going to discuss at the end of the show, or the latter half of the show, maybe the last third, the stereo aspects of it. I'm not going to get into that just yet, but that was obviously made things worse in terms of the rendering because you have to sort of render more stuff. So starting with you, Mark, just the robots, the animation, if you like, on the characters, be them the heroes or the villains, what do we think?
So there's several things that really attest to a franchise, if you will, or a director with a project going back to the same studio over and over again. So when I saw the first Transformers, I was pretty blown away at how complex the unfolding of these things were. But I was trying to figure out the whole time, like, well, did they really have to engineer and design exactly how these work, or did they kind of get away with some stuff? And I felt like it was the latter in some cases. On this film, because of how much more they had to do with them, I saw less room. I mean, there wasn't ever a lot of room for fudging, but I didn't see, for the most part, these characters had to do really specific stuff, and my God, there were, I mean, this has to be some record for polygons rendered in a live-action movie, right? It's got to be.
Got to be. I mean, it was, it felt, yeah, like, I mean,
I just couldn't believe how much detail was there and how many layers of production must have gone into, particularly the Colossus character, but, and then I found it a little distracting that, Optimus Prime had windshield wipers on his kind of his nipple area, but that's just me.
I think he always had nipple wipers, didn't he? I'm pretty sure he did.
Did he?
Yeah.
I just caught it this time. Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. And I guess you're with me then in thinking that while Ironhide and Megatron and stuff were all pretty amazing, that Colossus, the sort of drilling character, which obviously does make an early appearance in Chernobyl, but obviously comes back in a vengeance for the building destruction, was the thing that is the sort of takeout. If I had to sort of imagine myself 5 years from now looking back on this film, that thing destroying that building is the shot that really had the most impact for me. Would you agree with that, Matt?
Yeah, and it's what makes this film just astonishingly big.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree.
What do you think, Matt?
I would agree, and I think, yeah, that sequence and that whole, the sort of the big Chicago battle in general is so big. It's so blown out. It's kind of what, you know, I think any fan of this sort of film franchise, it's sort of what you wanted to see in Transformers 1 and Transformers 2, and you got tastes of those things. But this was really like the coup de grace. You know, this was really what you've been wanting to see all along, like something at this scale. They were with regards to the robots, the animation, the effects and stuff in general, I think, you know, it overall, I think it was magnificent. I mean, you know, and that's not a word I would use lightly. Like, it was really incredible stuff. I walked out of the theater and was sitting in the theater watching the film and feeling really like I was seeing something that was pushing the envelope to the extreme of what was possible at the present moment. And that's always something, I think, when you go to see an effects heavy film, when you see that and you feel it and you can sense that in what you're seeing on screen, that's an exciting thing. It's a palpable feeling when you see that. And I think, you know, ILM clearly from Transformers 1, from Transformers 2, and I think also too from all the work that Ben Snow and his team did on the two Iron Man films, I think they really have mastered that kind of hard surface you know, car paint, pearlescent kind of metallic flake kind of paint look in the materials as well, and the lighting and whatnot. It was stellar. There are a couple things from a compositing point of view that I think we should discuss at some point, and we don't have to do it right this second. But for the most part, this really was the robots and stuff who are the stars of the film. You know, they were great. It really blew my mind. I mean, and that's always a great feeling to walk out of a big summer blockbuster and feel like, wow, you know, we've crossed a threshold here. We've seen something new.
Well, let's discuss those composite shots. But let me just also flag, just for the record kind of thing, this is an ILM film, though Digital Domain did, I believe, about 350 shots. Now, there are other companies that we'll touch on that did stereo stuff, and we'll get to that. But DD did... probably easier to find what DD did than what ILM did, because they sort of did most of it. But I think DD did Laser Break, Brains, and also I think they did the Birdman sequence, the flying soldier sort of dodging the Decepticons through the Chicago skyline thing that I'm wanting to come back to. So with that as our basis, by all means, which shots do you feel like compositing-wise?
I think the compositing thing, and I think it's, I don't know if it's, I would say it's the fault of the compositor. I think it's partially a fault of the design conceit, again, of the shot. And it's something that, you know, King Kong had the same problem. The Transformers has this problem. Anything where you have a character of scale, like Optimus Prime or Bumblebee or King Kong or something, and then you have a physically reality-based character like Sam Witwicky or, Naomi Watts in King Kong, when you have that character holding the larger character in scale, holding a human character and or grabbing them or catching them and rolling with them, and you try to either do a digital double or some kind of combination of digital double and face replacement or blue screen, those shots are really difficult, and they're problematic, and I think they're hard to attain a level of reality that is something that, you know, I think we come to expect when we see these films, because some of the other work is so good. And there were some shots where Sam and the female character, whose name slips my mind, maybe a couple other characters were caught by the robots, and they were in their hands and stuff. And some of those shots were tough, and I think they're tough because they're tough to do. And I don't think they look good because the physics are wrong. And I think, you know, Scott Squires, he tweeted something back the other day to me and somebody else. We were talking about another film, and it was like, if the physics are wrong, you know, it will look wrong. And I think it's true, you know. And a shot like that, like when they're moving that fast in someone's hand, like their necks would break, blah, 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 et cetera, et cetera. And, you know, from a plot point of view, I don't care about that. But from a physics point of view, when you see it and you know that it's impossible, it doesn't work, and it can't work. And I think it also can't work even from a compositing point of view. And those were the shots in particular, for me, that really stuck out, were those the ones of that design.
Actually, the one like that that didn't work for me was when he used the whatever device he'd been given that had his hand shoot out, took out the eye of one of the characters. We're in Chicago, and he's now hanging on a wire being spun around, and he's acting like a pendulum, effectively, on the end of the wire as the robot tries to kill him, and the other army guy, whose name escapes me, comes in to get into hand, and they're kind of running around. And again, for the physics reasons, they seem to be moving too fast, and presumably body doubled didn't feel as good. By way of contrast, though, I thought one of the best Bay-esque sequences that was completely over the top but so worked and almost had cheers from, I think, our entire theatre is when Bumblebee does that move from being a car, converting into the robot, knocking bits of debris out of the way, and then grabbing Witwicky and putting him back inside himself and then reforming up into a car again, which Witwicky turns around and yells at him. It happened in the first half of the film. Do you know what I mean? It's like pretty much in slow-mo. And it is a spectacularly good sequence. And I know, because we're up at ILM talking to the guys about the film, that that was a really complex sequence that involved everything from the actor on green screen to body doubles to just incredibly complex timing, because it was all in slow-mo. It plays out really well. It's incredibly complicated. And I thought was just like that is the shot that is the sort of hallmark trademark of what makes the franchise good. It's funny. It has some character. It has just plays out on screen. You can see what's going on. And no, there was nowhere for ILM to hide, and they didn't need to because they friggin' nailed it, and it was just superb. So, you know, it's I don't know, maybe it was helped by being in slow motion. You'd think it wouldn't, right? You'd think that would make it harder. What about you, Mark? Was there anything that sort of stuck out as not being good?
Well, you just detailed out my favorite sequence in the film. And when I was listening to Matt talk about not... they kind of recapped it, right? Like it happened in more minor ways a couple more times, and but that was really the one. And yeah, it was just
it was great,
really
wasn't
great.
It?
And I love seeing. I just that was one of the sequences where it really feels like wow, they went for something that's just a classic VFX, like you know, like the moment in Jurassic Park when the T-Rex rips down the banner, which yep. at the time was, it just felt like just this iconic moment. So, but now listening to Matt, you know, I was just thinking about like, did I even like it because it was a little bit stylized? And I think maybe the answer is yes, but I didn't really, I don't have any complaints about that particular shot. I thought it worked.
That sequence where he goes from car to robot to car again. Yeah. I think was seamless. The one I was bitching about, was the one later on in Chicago when he takes out the eye of one of the Decepticons and he sticks up that, you know, lasso rope thing that's attached to his hand and he can't get rid of it and he's swinging around. That was the one that the physics seemed wrong and there was nothing you could do to sell it. I wouldn't say that the comp had the wrong black levels or whatever, but it just didn't feel like a good shot. Whereas the Witwicky car bumblebee sequence, you would just, you know, I mean, if I did that, if I worked on that, my showreel would be Mike Seymour, that shot, thanks, here's my phone number. That's it, nothing else. Just, that's it, you know. And quite frankly, if you didn't employ me after you saw that, I don't want to work for you because that would be enough. That would be like the calling card. I get business cards made up with shots from that
I like T-shirt. That. I like that mindset. I like that attitude. That's good. That's badass.
Let's discuss DD's sequence with the flying, because we've touched on it a couple of times, the Birdmen, for whatever better term, sequence where they come down. Now, we've said it's got some really big issues with what was going on in terms of the plot when they do it the second time. But the plate photography shot at 120 frames a second and the actual nature of those shots. Now, I understand it from John, who lives in Chicago. Those guys jumped in Chicago. Is that what you guys understand? So it felt good and it looked good and it was great cinematography. So one of the things I think that made that sequence work, because there were quite a lot of aerials through Chicago, but what made that work is it had just spectacularly good lighting. So whoever was grading, I think, did a really nice job on it. And it was just really good cinematography. So then when you added the VFX in, you almost couldn't go wrong. But as a VFX sequence, from what I understand, it would be the one that I think was probably the best work that DD did on this film. It was, I thought it was really, really strong. The first time when they came down, the way that the kind of camera moved, you have that sort of lateral movement left to right and the guys moving right to left through the buildings. It was, that was a very gung-ho kind of rah-rah coming to the rescue.
Yeah,
and it worked emotionally.
It was super exciting too. Like, I mean, I would imagine that you guys and probably a lot of people listening to this have seen there's like a Vimeo or a YouTube video of these guys in, I'm not even sure where they are. It's like Switzerland or something where they're like doing that kind of jumping with those wingsuits on and they're, have you guys seen that video? You know the one I'm talking about? And it's the first time I really saw these wingsuits in in action, and they shot it from, you know, from the cliff that they fly over, and then from the helmet cams and from the leg cam and whatever else. And it, I mean, it's just amazing, right? Where you're like, it looked like the flying squirrel or whatever, you know. And this, you know, I assume that Bay or some of the other people in this film saw that same thing, and they were just like, we got to get these guys, just like you were saying, Mike. And they were like, we're going to put these guys in the movie, and they put that in the film. And it's one of the most exciting sequences, for sure. That it's really fun to watch. It's incredibly well shot. And, you know, we were talking about a few weeks ago X-Men First Class and the flying sequences in X-Men First Class, and saying that that was some of the best flying stuff that we'd ever seen, right? I think it was what we were discussing. And I think this, you know, this in some ways is equal to that. I mean, it's really, really well
done. Oh, I think it topped it. I think it topped the X-Men stuff, yeah.
Yeah.
There were some good X-Men shots, but there were some inconsistent ones.
Right.
But the best X-Men shot was on par with the sort of normal shots from this sequence.
Yeah, yeah. It's part and parcel because, you know, part of this is like what John was telling you. Like, they actually did this, you know, and they integrated some of those shots into, you know, whatever visual effect shots they did with the, you know, whatever digital doubles they might have had or actors on against the screen, or I don't even know how they did those, but it looked great. Great looking stuff.
Okay, now in the Chicago sequence, and by the way, how nice it is to see another one of your American cities other than New York biting it. It was great. You know, we've had LA pretty recently and 2012 and stuff, and obviously New York is regularly rebuilt. But it's nice that you guys are spreading the love and starting to smash a few other places up.
Yeah.
But in a sequence like that, obviously, let's just think about like a normal shot sequence. You've got a plate photography of a city, and you're going to track that plate photography. And then the first thing you do before you put robots in is start tracking in all the destruction. So you're going to put in, like, you know, bits of broken buildings on top of the real building, so they have to match. It's a really good job for lighting. And quite frankly, if that doesn't work, the whole rest, everything else is falling over. So kudos to the lighters for matching the destruction patches that get patched on top of the real buildings. And then you're going to add in tons of atmospherics, like smoke and flames and stuff. And again, if that stuff looks fake or doesn't have scale or doesn't have the kind of high particle density that you need to have that at a sort of an epic wide shot, then it ain't going to work. But, you know, we've seen it before. And then you can obviously do character animations of the robots and put those into the sequences, add some lens flares and some, you know, bullets whizzing past or some tracer fire or whatever. And you've got a really good, you know, fight in a city kind of sequence. And then you take it to an entirely new level when you want to have Colossus eating that building and it falling over. And if they hadn't had the Colossus sequence, I would have felt like we had some really good sequences of the, you know, fights in the cities in the earlier Transformers one, in particular. The second one had some really nice sequences. But when it got to Colossus and that building, I mean, there was a point at which I just couldn't begin to calculate in my head how you'd go about doing that.
Yeah.
I mean, I know all the tricks in the toolbox, but it was just like, wow. Now, let's not beat around the bush here, right? This film, even in pre-production, before the film came out, there was stories about how many studios or people that had been working on it had to go to like 12 hours a day, cancel Easter Sunday, work, you know, 7 days a week. I mean, this was so much work. But I don't think, I really do, I don't think that there's any way that you would say this film looked like it was a rush job. If somebody had took all that publicity out of my head and said they had as much time as they wanted to complete this film, I can't imagine that sequence looking better. It didn't look rushed. It didn't look like they didn't have time to pull it off. So how they did that, even if they should have done that, is probably an ethical question we might address. But I definitely think that the Colossus building destruction was just unbelievably good. Now, should we discuss a bit of how it was done? There was an actual set built, right? That was like a sloping set for the actors to work on, like a gimbal,
mm-hmm.
as I understand it. And obviously, then it's just an enormous amount of Sims work and particle work. But I guess, Mark, just the amount of props. I mean, it's one thing to say Sims work when you're talking about just gratuitous bits of rubble and breaking, but like every lamp, every piece of paper, every prop of chair. I mean, that was just super detailed.
Yeah, my previous high watermark for this, I think, if I remember correctly, I mean, 2012, right, had You know, it's a fine line between doing something like they did there, where you're having a lot of fun knocking over buildings and flying planes through them, and you're recreating 9/11. And this one actually was going a lot closer to the latter, also in terms of realism and detail. And I mean, certainly those scenes in that gimbaled set, there's nothing really else you could, I don't know, that's what was on my mind. It was a little stressful, actually. But yes, it's literally like everything that would come out of a building that was tipped on its side feels like it was somehow represented. And whether that came down to little models of paper coffee cups and paper clips, I can't say, but it felt like they were there.
I mean, Matt, like it's something that, you know, pushed the render farm, as we said earlier, at ILM to its limit, and that's some pretty serious friggin' render farm. And I think I'm right in saying, from an article that was published in Hollywood Reporter, that there was 200,000 hours of rendering per day, or the equivalent of 22.8 years of rendering in a 24-hour period, as ILM basically took the entire farm on. But it didn't look rushed. I mean, that didn't look like it was not finished. That looked like it was polished, didn't you think?
Yeah, definitely. And I mean, I think that's, you know, when I was saying earlier in the discussion, you know, I feel like this is a movie that, for me, from a visual effects standpoint only, right, which is, this is the VFX show, like, I mean, it pushed the envelope. It pushed the envelope beyond anything that I had seen to date. And now I haven't seen the new Harry Potter film. I've heard it's great, you know, and, you know, that's a subject for another program, maybe.
The next VFX show.
Yeah, but this, you know, to the present moment, right now on July 20th at midnight here in Iceland, Transformers 3. Regardless of what you think about the story or the franchise or Michael Bay or the, you know, suction cup lip ladies or whatever, like, the visual effects in that movie, I think, are the state of the art. Top of the line, top shelf. I mean, going beyond what, you know, since the last film I worked on, at that level, in that capacity, at least up until now, like, I haven't seen anything like that. I haven't seen anything come close to that yet. Like, and it that sequence of the Colossus tearing through that building and every bit and piece that went into that sequence, even some of those big vista scenes of the of Chicago, like you were describing, where they've had to go, they shot the plate and they had to go in and you know, track the plate, match all the buildings, lay everything in, match all the black levels, get all the, you know, the dithering in the distance, do the comp with the big ships coming in, the, you know, fires burning, bits of glass and pieces of buildings falling down, like those huge sort of vistas that establish the scene of Chicago under siege. Even when we see our heroes come to town on their, you know, their Humvees or whatever, and they see Chicago kind of from ground level and distance, even those shots where it's kind of softer and out of focus in the background, those shots were equally great. You know, like, I think they took it to a level that I hadn't seen before. Across the board, and in that regard, you know, my hat's off to them. I mean, it really is just staggering, the amount of work that went into this, and it did not look rushed in any sense of the word.
Well, I want to now switch gears a little. I mean, I'd love to discuss the lack of villainy in McDreamy, and I'd love to discuss Leonard Nimoy and stuff like that, but they really would be going off into tangents to do with the filmmaking as a film review show. What I'd like to discuss is the technical aspects of the film. Now, just in terms of we used to care whether a film was shot stereoscopically or whether it was converted. We cared a lot, especially around the time of Titans. And we also used to care whether the film was shot on film or shot digitally captured. What I think is interesting about this film is that we thought, when it was being shot, that this was a digital capture film shot stereoscopically from a director who previously liked shooting on film and had said that he didn't like stereo and thought it was a bit of a gimmick. Yeah. And so then the pendulum swung the other way and we got the impression that this was all being shot digitally and stereoscopically. And that was a good thing because we didn't like Conversion as sort of a popular tech crowd. As the film has now come out, we've discovered that like Legend 3D, which is a really good company, that and Scott Squires led the team there, did a huge amount of stereo conversion work. And in fact, if you go and look through the film, about half the film, as it turned out, was stereo conversion for a couple of reasons. One, because Bay quite liked shooting with film cameras after all, and so wasn't going to shoot stereoscopically with film, especially on close-ups, especially on actors. Secondly, because you can just have problems with stereo stuff, so that's a big issue. And then thirdly, just with the nature of the beast, like, you know, you get in shots that are changed around and stuff, you're intercutting to B and C cameras or D and E and F G cameras on action sequences, and not all of those were just stereo rigs. They were never intended to be. So on a pure sort of shot count basis, there was less than half the film that was stereoscopically shot, and yet I don't know that we really care that much anymore, which is kind of pretty remarkable because I think it's only as little as like 12 months ago that we cared about that a lot. And secondly, I didn't notice, for example, that that some of the stuff was shot on the Red One MX, that some of the stuff was shot on the F-35, that some of it was shot obviously just on Ariflex or Panavision type stuff. I mean, it just didn't seem to be an issue that from a technical point of view, and it's sort of not necessarily VFX, but it's sort of VFX, everything got equalized out. What do you guys think? Am I right? Did we care? Did we notice?
Well, I actually approached Legend 3D during production of this on behalf of a company that was potentially going to take some of these shots off their hands because I think they had 1,500 of them. And at the time, I was mystified that they would leave that many shots undone. And now I guess there was a component of it too. I mean, I think ILM was also working with some shots that were 2D, and they may have even preferred it because it simplified their process. I don't know. The research was a little unclear on that. Like the reporting I heard about, it didn't really spell it out too clearly. But I did not have the previous film that I'd had a big problem with was Alice in Wonderland, and particularly the beginning sequences of that.
The live action, yep.
All the trees, I just...
Yep.
Ugh. And, I mean, come on, the amount of detail in this, I guess it was CG detail, so assumedly none of this work was done on any of ILM's output. They had to render both channels, but...
Actually, it's interesting that you mentioned Alice, if I can just interrupt you, because they actually went to some of the companies that did the Alice conversion, and they actually explicitly said, this is in an article that Scott Squires himself put me onto that was published in Variety, they actually said, look, the work that was acceptable on Alice isn't going to be acceptable on Transformers. Like, we've ratcheted up a notch. Because I agree with you. I don't think that was good. And I think the filmmakers and even the companies involved have moved now so far beyond that Alice is no longer considered to be an acceptable...
They get it.
Yeah. I mean, I will say, from having gone a little bit down this road, it's a lot of work to convert a shot like that. You have to do several passes of roto and then paint in the missing detail in a given plane of the shot, and, you know, not to mention figuring out what that plane is. And the problem they had in Alice, I perceived, was particularly with all those willow trees and things in the background that, you know, they just gave up. I didn't sense any of that on this. I also kind of liked the 3D in this movie. It didn't hit me over the head, but I was 20% more fond of watching this movie in 3D than I would have been in 2D, which is not like Avatar, where I think I was more like 100% more in favor of it in 3D. But I'm a bit of a detractor myself from the whole 3D thing, but I like this film in 3D. I appreciated the fact that they made it really bright. I took off the glasses at one point, and it was very, I mean, it was, they had definitely kicked up the luminance of the shots, at least a stop, to compensate for the polarizing effect. So, you know, it was a good experience, good viewing experience.
Yeah, and 3D. I just have to just throw a totally sort of non-VFX shout-out out there. If anybody wants to see what I think, in my opinion, is the best use of 3D that I've ever seen, you need to go and find a cinema that is showing in 3D Werner Herzog's film, The Cave of Forgotten Dreams, the documentary about the cave in France with the 30,000-plus-year-old cave drawings. And I think that is probably the best use of 3D I've ever seen. But that being that point being made, just for myself, I do think the 3D in this film worked. And I think everybody would know I'm not a huge proponent of 3D in general. I feel like it's still a bit of a gimmick, but at the same time, I do think all the 3D in this film I thought was really successful. It made it certainly fun to watch. It didn't detract from the film at all. There weren't shots that were executed in whatever format, and it was indiscernible to me. I felt like whether it was shot stereoscopically, whether it was done as a post-conversion, whether it was shot on digital video or if it was shot on 35 or whatever, it all melded together in a way that to me felt really seamless and it worked really well.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I think from my point of view, I think Prime Focus did like 230 shots, but as we say, most of them, as far as I understand, was done by the team led by Scott Squires, who obviously is ex-ILM himself and just an incredibly good guy. But the thing about Avatar is you went into sort of 3D fully computer-generated sequences, and we know they can work really well. Pixar has done superb 3D when it's fully generated. But it's a completely different game, as Scott himself said, when you're actually intercutting converted footage with non-converted footage, shot to shot, one after the other, as opposed to, sequences. And even in Alice, they kind of went into the world that was sort of digitally, artificially created that was not real, so it wasn't particularly pushing it. So I really think in terms of films that the state of the art is being defined, as we'll get into with Harry Potter Part 2 and this one, and it is a tough job whenever you're intercutting effects with live action that meant to be the same and seamless in the same way it is to cut converted and not. But I just felt like, wow, I can't believe that. I mean, notwithstanding the brilliant work that Scott Farr and his team at ILM did, which is just awesome, or Matt Butler and their team at DD, but I mean, it just seemed to me, I used to care whether it was converted or not. I used to care if it was shot digitally or film, and I so don't care that now, because it just doesn't seem to make any difference, that my take out of that is two things. Firstly, I can't see a lot of need to shoot film anymore, because honestly, the film didn't look better than the digital. The digital was holding
totally,
up really, really well. And
totally agree. Totally agree with you.
And, there are films that are still shot on film, but there aren't a lot of them. I mean, Harry Potter was one of them. And then the other thing is, it's got to be a hard ask to shoot stereoscopically, because I mean, there is more stuff on set, and it is, more kit, more gear, more everything. You can't be as nimble. You can't be as kind of on the shoulder, no matter what anybody says. And even with the smallest high-res cameras like the Epix, there's still a mirror rig, and if it's a mirror rig, it's quite cumbersome and quite big. I'm starting to think that once you get to a level that we're at here, that if I was at the meeting and somebody said conversion, then 18 months ago I'd have been really worried about that. But today, when you see those stickers like plastered across a trailer that actually says shot in 3D, and I've seen a few trailers that have actually said that. I think Three Musketeers, actually during the trailer for Harry Potter, I remember it came up and it actually said at one point shot in 3D, like that was a selling point. I'm thinking, well, does that make much of a difference anymore? I just don't think it does. I just think that if stereo is going to grow, and it could or couldn't, but I'm not going to get into that. But if it does, I'm going to say that a huge amount of visual effects are now able to be, or visual effects artists are now being able to employ doing the conversion process. Because as I think you said, Mark, it is a hell of a lot of work.
Yeah.
I mean, it's just heaps of work. Like, there is just no magic button.
I mean, I think we'll see a lot, too, with regards to the success or failure of all these endeavors, on what gets sort of greenlit next summer, and maybe even this holiday season, probably more likely next summer, though, with regards to 3D. I mean, given the numbers that Transformers has done so far, and the numbers that the final Harry Potter film has done in its opening weekend, and that they're both, primarily being shown, I believe, in a 3D format.
Yep.
I think that those, we'll see if that is enough to push it over the edge, because there has been some sort of back and forth and teetering. I know you say you don't want to get into that, but at the same time, I think, you know, it is interesting, and it does it. You know, if we're going to talk about the 3D, we have to talk, I think, to some degree about the viability of it in the marketplace. I mean, I think that's an important aspect of whether or not it succeeds or fails. And I think we clearly see in something like Transformers 3 that the quality of the 3D is really a function of, I think, the supervision and the commitment of, you know, the studio, the director, the producers, the personnel that are, you know, sort of flipping the bill, as it were. And, you know, on a technological level, regardless of how it's shot, you know, good 3D can be delivered, as this film proves. And if the audiences are willing to pay and go see it, I think, you know, that's, you know, then the proof is
But the reason why I didn't want to get into it is we'll just do a little bit, but my problem is I went to see Transformers because Scott Farr and the ILM team just are awesome. And I went to see Harry Potter because it's the end of the series that I've watched for the last decade, and I'm thrilled to be seeing the last installment of an absolutely brilliant, very complex narrative piece that has a really good story.
Interesting.
Scott Farr and ILM.
Yeah, yeah. And I see what you're saying.
And the story, and I chose to see them in 3D, partly because I do the show, partly because it seemed to be a good idea, partly because my kids would have killed me if I hadn't, because they wanted the everything experience they could get.
So maybe we won't see based on those factors, because, yeah, you make a good point. I mean, it's something that there are other factors that go into putting butts in the seats, as it were, you know, for both of those films. There's a whole nother host of reasons why people are going to see those that have nothing to do with the 3D aspect of them. So, yeah, we'll just have to wait and see. I guess the jury's still out.
I think I just said Scott Farr then. I think I meant to say Scott Ferrara, but I apologize.
I thought that was an Australian pronunciation.
Yeah, I did, too. I mean, you call me Matt Walden, and I figure that's Australian, too. So, you know, we're trying to be, you know, forgiving and generous here.
I'm sorry. Well, we've gone over a complete rat hole now, but I've completely lost my train of thought now.
Sorry.
So, Ted, the other thing is, whenever 3D fails, in other words, a film that is stereoscopically promoted fails, they always point to the 3D as the reason that it failed. And I would say that sometimes those films fail because they're just not very good films, and I didn't want to go and see them in 2D, yet alone in 3D. So I don't know that that's sort of, and then when they succeed, they very rarely say that they succeeded because they were 3D. Done. They
no, you're
always,
absolutely right.
Yeah, so
absolutely right. Totally.
All I'm saying is that my original point about this was, though, that if it goes ahead, and let's assume for this discussion it is, there is a huge number of jobs, just headcount, that are in the VFX crew already, but that's another massive number added to it with the stereoscopic conversion team. I mean, if ILM had a lot of people working on this, and they did, and Digital Domain, then that's sort of the additional work of the stereoscopic work sees a lot more artists employed in what you would call VFX work, or, I'm expressing it poorly. If you had a headcount of nuke artists, it got a lot bigger when it became a stereo converted film. Even though they may not be working in the VFX department.
Well, okay, we're going down a rat hole, so stop me if you want to stop me, because I don't want to go too far down this path necessarily, but I hear what you're saying, and I'm not saying I disagree with you in any capacity. However, is that an important, I mean, it's an important factor to us, to the audience listening to the show, maybe that's all that matters in the context of the conversation, but is that, like, jobs, is that an important aspect of the success or failure of 3D?
Well, it certainly is for me. I care a lot about jobs in this industry. I mean, what do you mean?
I guess I just mean, like, I guess it's sort of it's such an abstract question. As an art form, does it matter? Like, is it important to the art form of cinema, to the art form of visual effects, to filmmaking? Like, does that matter? Like, does 3D or not 3D matter? Is that one that I need to consider in whether or not I'm an advocate for 3D or not? Like, do I need to because the reason I ask is, and you know, I mentioned something about a film being made on another, like on an alias that I'm on of former ILM employees. It's a closed alias, and I said something just sort of flippantly, like not trying to make waves or anything. And somebody really thoughtfully responded to my flippant comment and had said something like, "Well, hey, you know, a lot of people get jobs because of these films. Like, why are you denigrating 3D?" And I didn't actually respond to him, although I thought he made a really valid point, not because I was trying to dodge his question, but because I kind of felt like we were talking about apples and oranges in a way. Like, my sort of flippant comment and my denigration of 3D was coming at it from sort of a snobby, anal retentive, purist filmic point of view, and not from sort of a visual effects, you know, labor point of view or anything. And he was sort of coming at it from another perspective.
Yeah.
Let me give you a bridge there.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I understand that. But you're talking about it from the art and from the jobs. But there is a midpoint, which is this show often discusses the influence, role, and importance of visual effects. And that normally is a huge part of the budget. I mean, a film like this, there's an enormous amount of the budget that is under the, you know, VFX category.
Sure.
But what's interesting to me is many of the same companies, many of the same individuals, many of the same skill sets are now in a whole new category that's in parallel to that, that's chewing up even more of the budget. So I'm not talking about the budget of this film, but imagine we had a blockbuster Hollywood film that three of us are producing, Mark's directing, and you and I are budgeting. And Mark says it's going to be stereo converted, and we go, great. Well, we've got $100 million. We're going to put, you know, $40 million into the VFX. We're going to get some actors, and hopefully they're good enough to hold it, but it's not going to be a star-driven piece. And then we're going to have to allocate another, you know, tens of millions kind of number to the same sort of people that we gave the money to for the VFX now, for the stereo conversion. Mm-hmm. So from a business point of view, not just jobs, but from a business point of view, that group of people, I mean, Scott Squires is just as home doing a work at Legend 3D as he is supervising a, you know, a film like Silver Surfer or something. So, you know, what I'm saying is that you've got even more of the budget being devoted to our peeps, our guys, our right. people. And let's face it, like, we should be advocates for those people. I mean, hell, we should be.
I mean, it can, maybe another bridge is it can work both ways, because 20 years ago when 2D animation films had their heyday and then suddenly Pixar kind of stole the mojo, it was really a bummer for a while that, you know, I mean, when it finally came to Disney effectively shutting down their 2D animation department, you know, that was a bummer, but the market spoke loud and clear. And this one is very much driven by the market, and it does affect people's jobs and careers and that of artists. This type of work is, I mean, it's really, I mean, not everybody's up to it, to be honest. It's even more hardcore than a lot of what you would call roto.
Absolutely. I think it's really insulting to the conversion guys to imply that it's a roto-only problem. Sure. I sometimes hear people saying they're doing stereo work. It means a bunch of roto artists sitting in India. And I'm like, I'm sorry, but the amount of work you have to go into and deep understanding of floating windows, stereoscopic conversion, parallax, and then just, you know, the physical solving the problem of dimensionalizing something, especially when there's smoke and flames and fire. And let's face it, on set of Michael Bay's films, even if you are going to add in a lot of stuff, you're going to have a lot of those elements practically around the actors on the ground. That's really hard work. In the same way that I find it offensive when people skip over rig removal on a, you know, like, I remember Die Hard 4 or Inception, you know, when they've got the just before the drop and the bodies are all wrapped up with cable and they're being floated towards the elevator lift shaft. I mean, that was like incredibly hard work, really, really good. Not as obvious, I guess, in one respect as you know, a big CG element, but one doesn't have to take away from the other. It's just good work. And I think you're going to get a lot of work for people in our industry doing stereo conversion, hopefully, that gets some recognition. Because at the moment, I really don't feel that those artists, they're almost like the mime artists to the VFX artists, right? They're like kind of second-class citizens a little. I don't think...
Well, but you could make the same case, and I know this case has been made, for visual effects artists in general. I know that there's efforts afoot to change that, you know, with the VES and some other groups kind of pushing for more. And, you know, certainly there have been films where, you know, the visual effects credits have been pushed, you know, sort of above the, you know, a Marquis de Salad catering credit or whatever, you know. So, I mean, I think there's efforts to make that the case, but I think visual effects in general, you know, sort of get short shrift, whether you're a stereoscopic conversion artist or, you know, a digital, you know, lighting artist or something on a given show. So, I mean, I think I guess the only reason I even bring
look,
it
the,
up
the TD that did the work on Ironhide being killed, right? Like, which is a kind of not a mega thing. Like, okay, so the TD on that had a really hard job and did a really good job. I don't want to take them down a notch, but I just want to maybe lift up a notch that the stereo conversion guys, who we all pretty much mocked around the time of Titans as being not producing stuff that we really felt was cinematic, have worked hard, improved their skills, and it's absolutely. And yet I still feel like they're a little not treated with kind of the respect they're due. Yeah. Now, I don't think that the top-of-the-line guys at the conversion companies – would kick the asses of the top of line guys at ILM, but then I don't think it needs to be an us or them kind of battle.
That's not what I meant at all. I guess, and I totally think you're right. I mean, I think you make a really good point there, which is that, you know, not only have they sort of upped their game, I think, you know, it's the way that this is being done is still a relatively new process, and so I think, you know, if Titans was you know, a stinker in that respect, if we want to single that film out. You know, part of that too is that, you know, there's a learning curve probably for some of this stuff too, not only just on an individual basis, but for these companies too, and the studios and the filmmakers, and just sort of figuring out, well, what is it that we need to do and how is it that we need to go about doing this? And the fact that on this film, you know, the shots that are converted as opposed to shot natively stereo are really indiscernible from one another speaks volumes to that fact that, like, you know, we have, or they have, as, you know, sort of a, you know, a part of the visual effects industry as a whole, they have sort of, you know, solved some of those problems and gotten things that were previously not working to work really well. And, you know, yeah, more credit to them for having done so. So, yeah, I mean, I think, Mark, in agreement with you on that.
So, Mark, you get an agent contacting you and saying he's got two projects. You can be a VFX soup on a $40 million picture, or you can have the same size project running on a $200 million picture, but you're in the running the conversion unit. So, in other words, you see what I'm saying? Like a bigger film, more sort of cred, but you've got, you know, the same amount of work in both cases. Are you naturally always going to go for the soup job, or would you consider the mega film, I mean, you know, Star Wars Episode 20? Do you see what I'm saying? Like, just as a personal individual, which way do you go?
Well, I've seen artists who really can't hack the conversion work because it's not... for many people, it's not why they got into the business. And I think I might slip into that camp a little bit too.
But you're totally... I mean, I'm not pissing in your pocket. You're, like, so capable of doing the work, just to be... Everyone that's listening to this, like, when Mark says he doesn't... You're not talking about talent here, because you could obviously easily do either. Personally.
Well, okay, let's just suppose that's true. But,
well, it is.
okay, fine. But be that as it may, I mean, that the conversion work, I think it'll provide a lot of jobs. And I think many jobs in our industry, really, there's only certain kinds of people who can do them. I mean, I see it over and over again. It's hard to put your finger on it, but I really, it's one of the reasons I would love to see the the salaries and working conditions and everything get worked out better, because it, this myth that there's people all around the world who are going to just take all the jobs, you know, and they'll go away is, I think it's a myth. And you point to something where I also think this is one of several, maybe the biggest untapped need. I mean, this is potentially a tidal wave of new activity, as you point out, in our business. So entrepreneurially, I'd love to run that unit. Creatively, I probably would say that I got into doing this stuff to work with the director on telling the story.
See, interestingly, I got approached by, and I can say this because they were quite open about it, I got approached by Animal Logic, and Animal Logic said that, and this, I said, this is not confidential, this is so open and current, that they were literally doing, running some courses, a month-long, full-time rotoscoping training, basically. And the idea was that you could learn these production techniques, and then Animal's doing this because they need to get a pool of really good rotoscope artists. So they're not saying that if you do the training that you'll necessarily get a job with them, but they are saying that they are running intensive one-month rotoscoping courses. And now, that's what they've officially said. I now will go one step further and say, and I'm guessing why they're saying that is because they've got stereo conversion work, and Animal's a really great facility. Now, that's a facility that's quite unprecedented to run a month-long intensive training course. They just desperately need people. And that would be a great way for somebody to get into Animal Logic, right? Because they can,
sure,
you know, train up at Animal Logic and do this kind of thing. You're right. I think only a certain group of people are right for that type of work. But there is just point-blank jobs in this area. And for an industry that, you know, has had some hard times, I guess all I was trying to say is that both strategically at a business level in terms of control of budget and funds flowing as much as anything, I think it's going to be tipping the balance towards conversion over shooting live action, because I just can't see that you could make the case that the converted films are poorer and that you get so much more by dicking around on set with mirror rigs. Now, Cameron may prove me wrong with Avatar 2 and 3 and Hobbit and stuff, but, you know, that's the way it sort of feels right now.
Yeah. No, I would agree. I think, you know, those are all really salient points. I think, I guess the only... the only thing I come back to is, I guess it just makes me wonder, like, if I'm... Maybe I'm just not a very good business person. I don't know. When it's all said and done.
Well, feel free to.
Well, I mean, this issue's going to get hotter because there are going to be films from the past that are going to get. I mean, it's going to be maybe not colorization, but I guarantee you there are some past blockbusters, right, that are getting.
Well, Star Wars.
Yeah.
Star Wars
has, although, Star Wars has been in the pipeline for a while.
Having seen Transformers and Harry Potter,
they were going to do the first Star Wars, but now they've said that they... I read just the other day that they've... Lucas has decided to pull the plug on doing anything other than just The Phantom Menace. That's what I heard, anyway. I don't know if that's true.
I hadn't heard that. Oh. But let's assume he's doing a Star Wars film. See how it goes. But having seen these two films this summer, your North American summer... I'm like thinking that Star Wars is going to look pretty good. You know,
yeah.
You'd asked me that question 18 months ago, right. I thought Star Wars is going to look pretty bad.
Right.
It's an excellent point. Yeah.
Anyway, that's a bit of a obviously massive rat hole, but I think it is at least on topic. I do think this film is incredibly successful stereoscopically in the sense that I didn't see, you know, even stuff that I was seeing in Dawn Treader, and I thought that was really good in terms of conversion. I think it's a unbelievable Oscar contender for visual effects, and obviously we've got some issues, but you know, we offer them by way of discussion rather than to detract from the awesome work. I mean, I always feel a bit intimidated criticizing this work, 'cause it's a bit like, well, you do better, you know, yeah. You and whose army, but it, I mean, you know, this is the state of the art for the industry. I'm looking forward to hitting Harry Potter in the upcoming ep, so we can kind of do a comparison, because I do think those are the two contenders. And I guess there may or may not be something else later in the year that we'll add in before we get to Oscar time. So we shouldn't shut the race down yet. But if the Oscars is a good indication of what our industry thinks is the best state-of-the-art work, and let's face it, in the VFX category, it tends to not be as biased away from things that make money as, say, you know, you never give a best actor Oscar to a guy who earned a lot of money. You always said give it to an obscure film. In the VFX Oscar category, that doesn't seem to be the case. So making it commercial success doesn't seem to preclude it from Oscar contention. It'll be interesting to see if it, you know, how it plays out. And I'd like to come back to you guys come pre-Oscar time and see whether your opinion of this film has withstood the test of time. Hey, thank you so much for being with us, guys. Where can people, catch up with you and see what you're up to? Mark?
Let's just go with Flow Seeker on Twitter and stick with that.
Excellent. And Matt?
MattWallen.com or on the Twitters at Matt Wallen.
I say Matt Wallen. What do you mean I say I don't say Wallen?
I've heard you say Matt Walden, like Walden Pond, which I think Wallen is kind of hard to say. It's very throatal sounding. It's an unusual name.
Okay. Well, I apologize if I've ever got your name wrong.
No need to apologize.
I respect you to get that.
Thank you. But can I ask one question on the air, if I may? Seagraph is like in two weeks. Is there any sort of VFX show meetup maybe going to happen?
Yes, we're going to try and do a VFX show live in Vancouver. We have good people working on it, meaning people like Todd, our obviously producer, but also Matt, who is going to be there with us, and Ian, who obviously is a contributor to the show, but also helping to pull stuff together for our stuff we're doing at Seagraph. We're doing a lot of stuff at Seagraph. And in fact, over at FX Guide per se, the main site, we're now very involved with Seagraph, both Seagraph and, in fact, the FX podcast is now sponsored by Seagraph Asia. So, yes, cool. Absolutely.
I would be really excited to meet as many listeners to the show at Seagraph. I'll be there this year, and it would be a lot of fun to meet some of the people who listen to the show.
We're going to have a meetup. So if you follow the VFX show Twitter feed, I'll give you ways that you can hook up with us. And obviously, if you follow me, Mike Seymour, on Twitter, you'll also get the same thing. I want to thank our producers and our team behind the scenes who put this stuff together. I want to thank you guys for listening to us. It's been a good discussion, actually, and hopefully you guys have enjoyed us kind of going slightly tangentially off onto some of the issues surrounding the work. Again, if you would like to see or hear us talk about other shows, please send stuff in. I know I've got some requests in for things like the early Spielberg film Poltergeist.
Tobe Hooper.
So we'll put that into the slot. Sorry?
Tobe Hooper, not Steven Spielberg.
I'm sorry. Anyway, we've got that coming down as part of our retro thing, but obviously in the middle of summer blockbusters, so as we say, Harry Potter's coming up next. Until next time, as I say, keep following us on the Twitters and keep your feedback coming. We love it when you guys email us stuff. I know a lot of people at the studios that make these films listen to them, which is kind of intimidating, but there you go. Thanks for being with us. Until next time, I'm Mike Seymour. See you guys.
If you have any questions or comments, please email us at vfx@fxguide.com. Copyright 2011, FX Guide, LLC.